The Dayton Literary Peace Prizes will be awarded on Sunday, November 7th. And the recipient of the Literary Peace Prize this year for fiction is Marlon James for his book, The Book of Night Women. And we'd like to welcome him into the Book Nook today. Marlon joins us by telephone from St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vic. Thanks for having me.
Marlon, am I picking up a little bit of a, is that a Jamaican accent?
It is. I'm very distressed that you said little bit. I like to think I'm still strongly Jamaican.
Well, you're getting better. It's coming out stronger.
Yeah, I grew up in Jamaica. I was born there. I was born in Jamaica in 1970, and I've lived there most of my life. I've been living in Minneapolis now since 2007. But that's where I'm from, and that's pretty much where most of my books are still set.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you end up going from your youth in Jamaica to being a professor at McAllister College?
Man, it's all, nobody believes me when I say it's all through the power of Google. But I'd gotten my degree. I took a very long break between my BA and going back for my master's degree. In fact, it was like around 16 years. And having this degree, I certainly wanted to teach. And I kind of also wanted to get out of Jamaica. It's still a situation, I think, with the Caribbean and with a lot of countries that most of the prominent writers from the Caribbean no longer live there. Because it's as great as the Caribbean is, it doesn't necessarily support being a writer. And I wanted a career that, supported my being a writer, which in this case was teaching. And I actually did it. I Googled creative writing tenure track, and McAllister came up first.
So for real?
Yeah.
You're not putting me on.
No, I'm totally not joking. I applied, went for the interview. The interview itself was a joke. In a way, but the interview wasn't a joke, but the story is pretty funny because I don't think they were aware that I wasn't based in the States. So I flew to the States and then jumped on a bus and drove to Philly to do this interview. As far as they're concerned, it happened to be coming to Philly. I wasn't. So,
right.
So I did all of that and, left Philly, went back to New York, flew back home and did not get the job. And I'm not sure. I think somebody here quit suddenly, and they offered me a visiting position, and I took it anyway. It was a one-year job, but I still shipped all my stuff. I have a very sort of, I'm a big believer in dumb luck. After a year, they offered me a position here, a tenure track position, and I took it. So. So I'm no use when people hire me for career talks because I was going to sit down and wait for dumb luck to happen. That worked for me.
Or try Google. Yeah.
And Marlon, so that was the short version of the trip from Jamaica to here.
I love that. Marlon James joins us. Back in February of last year, I was on a plane flying across the Pacific, and I had brought a book with me that I thought would be the perfect book to read on a long plane trip, and it was your book, The Book of Night Women. And as I read it, I was headed to Hawaii. I was headed to a relaxing vacation, but I wasn't relaxed after I'd been reading your book for a while because I thought, wow, this is intense. This is heavy. Your book is set in Jamaica. Tell us about it.
Well, it's set in Jamaica in the late 18th, early 19th century, between, I think, 1785 and 1801. And it's about a bunch of women, the night women, who plot this revolt. And initially, it seems like an all-female-driven revolt. And at the center of it is the slave Lilith, who was born in very, very mysterious circumstances. She commits a really, really violent act, and that immediately gains the attention of the night woman because they want women who are not afraid to shed blood. But as she gets embroiled in this rebellion plot, all the ambiguities and all the internal clashes start to rise. There are people who are betraying it from the inside. There are people who have all their own different selfish reasons for doing it. Lilith herself is ambivalent because she starts to fall for an overseer. So there is all those sort of very tricky dynamics of relationships between slaves and slaves, and slaves and masters, free people and people in bondage, and it just all sort of explodes near the end.
There's really a complex hierarchy here. As the book opens, Lilith is being put in kind of a favored position, but throughout the slaves, you have various levels of enslavement, don't you?
Yeah. The distinction among slaves was certainly more pronounced, and there are certainly more different categories than the distinctions with the white owners. It was basically white and not white, especially in a slave colony where it wasn't in the Europeans' interest to keep the class system there, because you needed everybody. If you're in a country like Jamaica, 90% of the population is slaves. You don't have time. The person who you wouldn't have paid attention to in British society is, for example, the Irish. You know to depend on. So that was pretty much democracy before its time. With slaves, it was different. And other things caused that distinction. One was skin color. You know, if you were half white, a quarter white, if you're a mulatto or a quadroon or an octoroon, that immediately puts you on different levels of the hierarchy. Hmm. If you were more expensive than the others. And then also there's the slave situation. You have the field slaves. You have the common field slaves who do the menial work. You had house slaves. You had the slaves with skills. And they all, not only were they on different levels than each other, they also enforced it. So if I was a pretty privileged slave, I probably showed you more prejudice than the white owner did.
Was it the Johnny Jumpers that were kind of at the top?
They kind of were at the top. The house slaves would have really been at the very top.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of money, one can easily replace a Johnny Jumper. You just get the meanest person in the slave gang and give him a whip.
Mm.
Somebody who can actually shoe a horse, or anything that's very any sort of skill. Those were the most valuable. Mm-hmm. What used to happen is, if I had the best blacksmith in the village, in the estate, I could hire him out to other estates.
Uh-huh.
So those people, the skilled laborers, were in a lot of ways the most valuable. Certainly were the most expensive.
Mm.
A lot of these slaves knew that, and they in turn practiced prejudice. They in turn practiced exclusion from one another. It's like, you're just a lowly... you're just a lowly common slave. I'm not talking to you. So it's different levels of discrimination going on.
Marlon James joins us. His book, The Book of Night Women, has just been named the recipient of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for Fiction. And he's going to be in Dayton on Sunday, November 7th. He'll be here to receive his award. And this book, you have some very strongly developed characters in the book, and some that just jump into my mind are the slave owner, the overseer that you alluded to, who is Irish and has this love affair with Lilith. And one who's particularly compelling to me is the former overseer, or the older overseer. And then there's the woman who is really kind of the ringleader of the rebellion.
Right, Homer.
She's an amazing character.
Homer was a very interesting character to write. I've made no secret of how much I'm indebted to White Sargasso Sea, Gene Reese's novel White Sargasso Sea, largely because I understand that dynamic so much, the country coming out of slavery, and also because it was such an ambiguous book. There's an estate in the second estate in my book is called Culebra, which is explicitly from White Sargasso Sea's Culebra. But Homer was the character that influenced Homer the most was this character Christophine in White Sargasso Sea, who was sort of the head slave. And the head slave, as long as she remembered her quote unquote place, pretty much runs the estate. As long as she doesn't kid herself that she is the mistress. She actually is the mistress. And Homer, despite having this position of privilege, never got over the atrocities that was done to her. So it was very interesting writing that and have that character unravel. So she was a very interesting character to write. The character who was, to me, was most interesting actually was Miss Isabel, who is a white girl from the neighboring estate, and she also goes through a lot of trauma as well. And she's interesting because Miss Isabel is the type of character that appears in a lot of 18th century fiction. She's a mysterious, darker-skinned mistress in Mansfield Park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is the mad woman in the attic in Jane Eyre.
Uh-huh.
The Caribbean white woman who may have been tainted. And there's a scene in the book where Miss Isabel goes on about what Edward Long says about her. Because he wrote this history of Jamaica, and he has this long rant about the corrupted nature of the white Creole mistress. That was very fascinating to write with a person who, in a lot of ways, may actually run into more prejudice because she looks white, but her skin's too tanned, and she speaks, sounds black.
She's a difficult character. Do you see her as a sympathetic character?
I don't know. I think...
Sounds like you just got an email. I heard a little bell.
I should hide that.
Is that your email?
No, it's the iPhone.
Oh, the iPhone. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go on. Miss Isabel.
I don't know if she's sympathetic so much as pathetic.
Uh-huh.
It was really important for me that she remain a human and a real character, that she was a woman who was raised with a certain expectation that she's going to live a life of privilege. She's going to marry an owner of a major estate with a lot of property and making $30,000-$40,000 a year, and she will be taken care of. She was raised to not be able to take care of herself. And that archetype, that woman didn't die in the 18th century. That woman is Caddy Compson in Sound and the Fury. That woman is Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire. That's how she was raised, with that expectation, and that gets just horribly, you know, taken away from her. So I did, on one hand, feel a lot of sympathy for her, but a lot of her wounds are self-inflicted too, and she's not really a nice person.
No, she's not.
Mm.
In fact, there are a whole lot of not nice people in mm-hmm. this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, part of it, too, is it's still slavery. And slavery was one of the longest-running atrocities. It's finding a lot of sympathetic people on a slave estate is sort of like finding sympathetic soldiers in a concentration camp. That's not to say they weren't there, but this is, and you're on an entire social system that's run by human beings at their worst.
Yeah.
So finding that sort of redemptive thing is really hard. The redemptive scenes, I think, in this book are the ones where the slaves take on that for themselves. For example, when they're teaching themselves to read.
This is based on real history, isn't it?
Slightly. As far as I know, not a female orchestrated rebellion. Would have been really interested if there was one. But Jamaica is a country that was always on revolt. There's a scene, there's a chapter where there's this sort of litany of all the revolts. And all of those revolts happened.
Hmm. I guess that's why I thought it must have been real.
No, it was just something that really, really fascinated me. All the revolts, and quite a few of the really minor characters are actually real characters as well, like Thomas Thistlewood and so on. These people really existed, so I actually wanted them in there. But the actual sort of female-led rebellion didn't happen. There were women who were very instrumental in it. One of the Maroon chiefs in Jamaica was a woman. But that in itself didn't happen. Rebellions of that scale did. And rebellions with that sort of damage and that sort of anarchy did happen, but that specific one, not really.
Marlon James joins us. His novel, The Book of Night Women, came out earlier this year in paperback, and it won the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for fiction this year. He will be in town on Sunday, November 7th to receive his award. I assume you're also going to be giving a little speech.
Yes, at least that's what I'm figuring, because I've been on the Dayton Peace Prize website, and I see there is, I think it's a 4 or 5 minute speech.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm going to say yet.
Is that enough time?
For me, yes, so that I don't end up rambling on and on.
Okay.
I just gave a speech, a send-off speech to a graduating class here. I told him it was a 5 minute speech. It ended up being a 28 minute speech.
Okay. Well, congratulations on your award.
Thank you.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised. I had heard of the award, and a friend of mine won it 2 years ago. Juno Diaz won it 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
For his really, really incredible book. I was surprised. I was certainly surprised at I was pleasantly surprised at the nomination. I was very surprised at the win, actually, because I know I've read. I've read all the nominees. I've read Abraham's book, and I've sort of read Chimamanda's book. She was here a month ago, and we had a live discussion about her book and the issues that it raised. So I was sort of surprised. In the sense that what I'm writing about is something that happened nearly 200 years ago,
uh-huh.
Except that it's still happening, and there is still gross injustice being committed on large groups of people. And I think as long as that happens, then maybe this book is relevant.
I was a big fan of the Oscar Wilde book 2 years ago, and I was delighted when that book was chosen, and I'm thrilled that your book was picked too, because these are books that I read when they came out in hardcover and just said, wow. And I don't mean Oscar in regard to your book. I'm guessing from all the literary references that you've been making that you are a voracious reader.
I am pretty convinced I ruined my eyesight because of reading. I have a library right here in my office. I have one at home, and I have another one in Jamaica. So I am a pretty voracious reader. One of the things that was most fun for me about writing Night Woman is that it's a book about books.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to play with one of my favorite ever books, Joseph Andrews, because I'm a big fan of Henry Fielding.
Mm.
Joseph Andrews, there's one point where I used to read Pride and Prejudice every year. I can quote lines in Pride and Prejudice. I do it much to the annoyance of my students. And one of the reasons being in Jamaica, certainly when I was growing up in the 70s, there really wasn't that much to do. What we did have, I'm not sure if it's there now, but what we did have were really great libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how that happened. It was a Jamaican library I discovered Rudyard Kipling. It's a Jamaican library I first read Norman Mailer, first read Virginia Woolf. All this was in libraries in Jamaica. And since, bookstores were trying very hard, but there weren't a lot of books there. And a lot of times you couldn't afford them anyway. So libraries just became your best friend. And when I grew up, that was one of my big ambitions, to have my own library. It was, reading. You have to. The only way you can come by a huge desire to write is if you've read. And you have what Marquez calls that book that gives you permission to write.
Uh-huh.
And for him, it was The Metamorphosis by Kafka.
Uh-huh.
For me, it was Shame by Salman Rushdie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I read that book. I remember reading that book. I was in church, and I had it in front of my Bible. And the preacher, this is a Jamaican church, so we're talking lots of hellfire and damnation.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, this generation is going to hell. And I'm like, ha, 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 because I'm reading Shame. And after reading that, I remember reading, I mean, I was writing before and all of that, but after reading Shim, I was like, no, this is it. This is what I want to do. And I'm going to start doing it now.
I'm going to guess you also have a huge record collection.
I have a huge record collection.
How did I know that?
I don't know. Somebody on Facebook told you.
Yeah. How much did you end up bidding on that Miles Davis live?
Oh, God. I ended up bidding, I think it was $92.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, you know, Live Evil is one of my favorite Miles Davis albums. Don't tell anybody I said this, but it's better than Bitches Brew. But I didn't say that.
Okay.
And
we'll edit that part out.
But it's so hard to find. And, of course, as soon as I paid for it, there was another one there for $30. You know, in a lot of ways, I'm even more inspired by music and film than by books. I don't write in silence. There's always music playing. The first book I wrote, I was listening to this band. I think it's a band from Texas, 16 Horsepower, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where I was using lines from it and had to get this permission. When I came here in the Twin Cities, I had no idea it was such a huge LP culture. I remember I was in somebody's house, and I was being blown away by what they were playing, and I went and picked up the jacket, and I was like, Tears for Fears? Really? And I forgot that there are things you will forgive on LP that you won't forgive on CD.
Because
LP is so warm.
I agree. The sound is completely different, isn't it?
Yeah, and I went back. I got this... somebody gave me his turntable, and I went straight back to LPs, and now it's threatening to take over my house.
Well, they certainly take up more space, and you need to love them a lot more.
Yeah, it's funny. My high school yearbook says my ambition in life is to work for Prince.
As in Prince from the Twin Cities?
Prince from the Twin Cities.
Okay.
So I'll call friends from high school, and I go, guess where I'm living? I'm like, no, no. It's like, yeah. I'm like, you're not working for him. They said, no, I'm not working for Prince. I'm an English teacher.
But you wear a raspberry beret, no doubt.
No, but I did have a purple trench coat.
Okay.
Which is very hard to pull off in a country that's 90 to 106 degrees.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You're from Jamaica. Are you a fan of music from the islands?
I am, but I have a very weird relationship with reggae. It's sort of like a relationship with a family member. I'm absolutely totally familiar with it. It's part of my language. It's part of my DNA almost. But it's like a family member, so I take it for granted. I don't listen to it all the time. I rarely listen to it now. And to the dismay of a lot of reggae fans who come across, I was like, so, man, it must have been great growing up with Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and such and such. I'm like, actually, I was listening to the Human League and New Order. No.
That's about 1985, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when I was a teenager, I was like, so that new Steel Pulse is great, isn't it? I'm here listening to Prince and Bruce Springsteen. I can talk to you about The River and Born in the USA.
Let me guess, Spandau Ballet.
Yeah, but not to the point where I'd buy that album. Okay. I was more New Order and Depeche Mode.
Okay. Very electronic.
Yeah. Well, it's the 80s.
Right. So what are you working on? Are you writing anything right now?
I'm working on a novel right now. I'm a big believer if you talk about novels, you jinx it. So all I'm going to say is it's set in 1976. And I'm going back to trying to figure out all my disco slang.
Oh. Yeah, that was the height of disco in 76, wasn't it?
Yeah, and so my characters, it's fun. I like playing with language, and I like getting back into how people spoke at a certain time. I've spent the bulk of my research just on etymology. For this, it just means watching a lot of Saturday Night Fever and American Graffiti, but just getting back into how they spoke. People said ace an awful lot.
Ace?
Yeah, like, I'm going to that party is going to be ace. Like, okay.
I missed that one.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I must say your language in the Book of Night Women, there's some impressive dialect and just verbal stuff in here that was pretty amazing to read. Is this stuff that you really had to research?
Some of it, because modern day, you know, especially dialect. Dialect gets its references from a lot of contemporary and a lot of pop culture. So if I'm going to write about 1800, I couldn't use how people speak now. How people speak now is influenced by the last thing said, you know, what people say in hip-hop and all of that. So some of it, so a lot of that was research. Some of it is just some guessing. I said before, I'm a big fan and scholar of Jane Austen and Henry Fielding, and sometimes it's just a matter of if I were an African slave picking up the language of the people around me, what would I sound like? And that drives a lot of it. If especially in Jamaica, there would be a lot of very, very rich attorneys. There would also be very, very, not necessarily poor, but certainly working class Welsh and Irish. And a lot of the Jamaican accent is actually very, we still use a lot of Welsh expressions, like Pickney is actually Picaninny, which is Welsh. So a lot of that is, some of that are new, and some of it was guesswork, and some of it was going back to old songs from that era. And sometimes witness reports, because slave narratives didn't really help with language, because the aim back then was to make it standard English so that the British could read it.
Well, the book really stayed with me. It was one of my favorite books that came out last year, and I'm just delighted that you've been recognized by the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for this.
It is a pretty great honor, actually.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah.
You'll be in town on November 7th.
I will. I might be in earlier. I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Well, Marlon will be in for sure on the evening of Sunday, November 7th, to get the award. He'll be speaking, and that's going to be at the Schuster Performing Arts Center in downtown Dayton. For information on the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, they have a website. It's DaytonLiteraryPeacePrize.org. His book is The Book of Night Women, and it won the prize this year. And we're just delighted to have you on the program today.
It was a great time. It was great being here.
Well, it's our pleasure, too. Thanks so much, Marlon.
Thanks.
Our guest has been Marlon James, and his book is The Book of Night Women. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. I hope you've been enjoying our weekly broadcast of The Book Nook on WYSO. If you miss any of our interviews, you can still listen to them by going to our website at wyso.org and clicking on the Book Nook page. You'll be able to download podcasts when you do. Tune in next week for The Book Nook when we welcome back to the program the novelist Katrina Kittle. Her new novel is called The Blessings of the Animals. That's coming up next week, right here on the Book Nook on your public radio station, WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.